But if he's got public support on his side, he doesn't care if he has ignored the law. So I think he's teeing himself up for future action.
Alaska's congressional delegation denounces Obama's move to protect Anwar. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study rewrites assumptions about charitable giving.
The old story of the villages outside of the main hubs taking isn't totally true in a lot of ways.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil, Mat-Su Health Foundation, and Alaska Children's Trust.
Alaska's governor and congressional delegation are furious over President Obama's announcement this weekend that he's seeking wilderness status for the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That would put the area off limits to oil and gas development. But permanent wilderness designation would require congressional approval, and this Republican-led Congress is unlikely to grant it. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports on what else is at stake.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, flanked by Congressman Don Young and Senator Dan Sullivan, faced national reporters at the U.S. Capitol, projecting ferocity.
We have said as a delegation that we will not stand it, we will not tolerate, and we will do everything that we can to push back against an administration that has taken a look at Alaska and decided it's a nice little snow globe up there, and we're going to keep it that way.
Murkowski says wilderness status for Anwar is just one of three gut punches the Interior Department plans to deliver this week to Alaska's economy. She says Interior Secretary Sally Jewell's chief of staff, Tommy Boudreau, told her about them Friday. Punch two will be withdrawals from the Arctic Offshore Leasing Program. Punch three, Murkowski says, will be to the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, where ConocoPhillips needs a road to develop its Greater Moose's Tooth project. Murkowski says the government intends to impose conditions that will add $40 million to the cost.
If it's not off limits, we're going to make it so hard and so expensive that no operator is going to want to do it. Is this how you treat a state?
Murkowski says she intends to use her committee positions to try to block the actions legislatively and through her control over the Interior Department's budget. She mentioned a possible lawsuit. She also says the congressional delegation will work to educate the rest of the country on how much care Alaska's industry takes to avoid harming the land or animals. Congressman Don Young told reporters the industry does no harm to Arctic wildlife.
I mean, that's the nonsense. And the public guy in New York and Miami or Philadelphia or San Francisco, oh, we got to save those poor little animals. It doesn't affect them. Never has. It's all a myth, easily sold to the less knowledgeable people.
Once the administration formally requests wilderness status, it intends to manage those parts of Anwar as wilderness. Environmentalists who support the plan say it won't make a big difference on the ground because industry isn't allowed there anyway. The government says in its plan it intends to keep subsistence access the same. Murkowski says she believes Obama's wilderness request is just a prelude.
Lisa's theory, I think that they are advancing this in an effort to get environmental support, to raise money for the cause.
As she sees it, Obama is trying to drum up his base so that he can then declare Anwar as a national monument, an executive action to lock up the area. Murkowski says that would violate the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which says congressional approval is required to reclassify large tracts of land.
Even though he would violate the terms of ANILCA. But if he's got public support on his side, he doesn't care if he has ignored the law. So I think he's teeing himself up for future action.
While Obama's move has Alaska officials fuming, environmentalists are thanking him. Cindy Shogan of the Alaska Wilderness League says it'll still be tough to get a wilderness bill through Congress, but she says Obama's commitment to the issue helps. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Meanwhile, a proposal to create a federally protected marine reserve around the Aleutian Islands has stalled out. On Friday, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that the Aleutians won't advance in the process to become a national marine sanctuary, mostly due to a lack of local support. ADAC, King Cove, Accutane, and the Aleutians East Borough all came out against the nomination. Environmentalists and research groups had been seeking permanent limits on commercial fishing and a ban on oil in the Bering Sea. At more than 730,000 square miles, it would have been the largest marine sanctuary in the country. In a letter, a NOAA representative suggested that a smaller area could be eligible, but the agency would still need proof that other interest groups are on board. There are 13 national marine sanctuaries around the United States, each with its own local management panel. Those groups can advise NOAA on new regulations for commercial activity inside the reserves. A new fishery approved by the Federal Subsistence Board last week will allow the use of set gill nets on the Kenai and Kisilof rivers. The Nanilchik Tribal Council submitted the proposals, which will allow the subsistence community there to use one 60-foot-long set gill net for sockeye on the Kenai River between June 15th and August 15th. Up to 4,000 sockeye could be harvested with the subsistence permit, in addition to as many as 1,000 king salmon. That was the main point of contention on the board's 4-3 vote. And it complicates an already tough-to-manage fishery, says Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Robert Begich.
With more harvest because of another user group, if the fishery does grow or they are effective at harvesting, that harvest needs to be accounted for in the daily management of the fishery, in-season fishery, because we do get daily sport harvest estimates. So we would hope that this harvest would be added to a program by the managing federal staff so that we could get it daily as well.
The federal staff in charge is at the Kenai Wildlife Refuge, and they would have to approve any permit applications and operation plans for the fishery. Subsistence users are already allowed to use rods and reels, dip nets, and fish wheels. Subsistence communities in Cooper Landing and Moose Pass will also be allowed to apply for permits. A biologist from the U.S. Geological Survey has been appointed to lead the state's habitat division. Tony DeGange is currently the chief of the Ecosystem and Geography offices at the Alaska Science Center. He says he was approached by Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton about the job, and he supports the division's conservation mission.
As more and more people live on the earth and there's a lot more development, you know, we have a responsibility to take care of our natural resources, and then when we do development, to try to do it in a way that minimizes impacts to fish and wildlife.
DeGange takes over the position at a time when the division is reconsidering its habitat management process. Management plans for the state's sanctuaries and reserves, like the McNeil River Refuge and the Bristol Bay Critical Habitat Areas, were being rewritten under the previous director, Randy Bates. The policies were targeted by a petition campaign that described the changes as a rollback, and Bates was removed from the position earlier this January. The process is currently on hold. DeGange says he will now have to figure out what to do with those plans.
Well, the criticisms were that the state wasn't following a highly transparent and public process. That's one of the first things Sam Cotton has charged me with, is coming up with a recommendation on how to move forward.
DeGange says those recommendations will likely come next month. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, packing food drop bags for the Yukon Quest dogs, beaver carcasses, and all.
For some reason, this stinky, gross beaver meat is just absolutely one of their favorites.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by the 2015 Statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
Having healthy and plentiful returns of salmon each season is an important issue to subsistence, sport, and commercial fishermen alike. But relatively little is known about what happens to the fish once they leave their spawning grounds and head out to sea. A group of scientists have started investigating a piece of the puzzle in a survey of juvenile Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. As APRN's Josh Edge reports, they unveiled their findings last week at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium.
Bristol Bay sockeye can account for nearly 60% of the world's harvest each year, but the fish's returns vary greatly. Scientists believe a large portion of salmon mortality occurs in their first year at sea, and they think size can play a vital role in fish survival. Ellen Yasumi Ishii is a research fisheries biologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So it's important for them to be large and have extra lipid reserves before they go into the winter in order to survive.
A larger fat reserve means more energy for the salmon in winter when food is more scarce. During the study, Yasumi Ishii and her team found that, no surprise, the smaller fish are typically at a disadvantage.
They swim slower and they have to compete for food with other fish, so they might not be getting as much food as they need to as the other fish. And they might also be a prey item for larger species that feed on the smaller prey.
The study indicates salmon over 180 millimeters long, or about 7 inches, have the highest survival rates. Yasumi Ishii's team also discovered a difference in diets between warm and cold years. She says in warmer years, juvenile salmon fed primarily on pollock.
Those are a lower energy rich prey. And whereas in cold years, they're feeding on euphausids, which are crustaceans. So it would be like the difference between me eating McDonald's fish sticks for dinner and king crab. So that crab, that crustacean, provides that extra lipid concentration that they need.
Yasumi Ishii says the difference in diet is likely a function of which types of prey are most abundant at the time. Even though the quality of prey differs depending on the ocean temperature, she says there are a number of other factors in play affecting salmon returns, which vary greatly regardless of whether it's a cold or warm year. Close to 54 million sockeye are projected to run in Bristol Bay in 2015, which is the largest forecast in 20 years. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A recent study about Alaska nonprofits confirms what many in the field know, that federal grant money has been drying up over the past couple of years. On the other hand, it shows that nonprofits are developing new revenue streams and counting on personal giving, particularly in rural areas. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more from Bethel.
Andrew Cutting is Director of Nonprofit Research and Partnerships at the Anchorage-based Foraker Group, which offers training and assistance to Alaska nonprofits. He says their study shows that Alaskans are generous.
Alaskans are very giving. I mean, some of these statistics just point to the dollar amount, but we know they're giving in lots of ways. But this really gives us hard numbers on how Alaskans are giving in their communities, and we see that in rural communities, they're giving at a much higher percentage than most urban areas.
In 2010, Alaska nonprofits received $3.3 billion from the federal government. By 2013, that number had been cut in half to $1.5 billion, and it's expected to continue to decline in the current economic climate. The study shows that nonprofits are counting on earned revenue, which has grown substantially, and personal contributions to make up for the gap. Southwest Alaska residents stand out in their giving. The Lower Kuskokwim's giving ratio, based on itemized tax returns, is 3.5%, compared to 2.7% in Anchorage. That's above the national average of 3%.
Bethel tends to be one of the outstanding ones. We always see blips in communities over time, but Bethel tends to be higher than average and higher than the state year after year after year, so it's definitely a giving community.
Overall, the study says Alaska nonprofits are adapting by finding new sources of earned revenue, such as selling goods and services as federal grants are reduced. And with state funds also looking iffy, that's good, says Cutting. He says nonprofits will have to be nimble, adjusting their funding strategies and diversifying their funding sources over the next few years. He adds that the shift to local giving creates a new narrative for rural Alaska.
The old story of the villages outside of the main hubs taking isn't totally true in a lot of ways. village communities are really providing for themselves by donating at very high percentages.
Alaska has a lot of nonprofits, about 5,700, which are providing a substantial number of jobs. Health and social services dominate the nonprofit sector in the state and nationally. The national norm for nonprofit employment is 10.6%. In Alaska, it's 12%. And in rural Alaskan communities, that percentage tends to be even higher. For example, in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, where the nonprofit sector accounts for half of the workforce. Many of those workers are employed by the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel. The only community that had a higher giving ratio in the state was Southeast Fairbanks. Besides Anchorage, Foraker Group also has staff in Fairbanks, Sitka, and Willow, and has worked in over 200 villages. The study was released in December. There's a link posted at kyuk.org. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
More than 200 business leaders, researchers, and policymakers gather in Juneau this week for the 2015 Innovation Summit. The two-day event is a time to listen, discuss, and brainstorm about Southeast Alaska's economic future. Brian Holst is Executive Director of the Juneau Economic Development Council, the summit's organizer. He says speakers and participants will focus on new ways of doing business.
These are entrepreneurs and university people and people involved in the business world or supporting business that have experienced innovation in their own work, in their professional work.
The Innovation Summit runs Wednesday and Thursday at Juneau Centennial Hall. There is a registration fee.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The state of Alaska reminds you to file online for your 2015 PFD on MyPFD. Paper applications are located at distribution sites in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message is sponsored by the state of Alaska. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Two Sandpoint men are facing federal charges after allegedly breaking into the town's post office in late December. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
21-year-old Sheldon Shiravloff and 18-year-old Keith Lee Wilson Jr. were indicted on Thursday on charges of burglary with intent to commit larceny and conspiracy to commit burglary. An unnamed 17-year-old is also facing juvenile charges in connection with the alleged break-in. The state is handling that part of the case. Sandpoint Police Chief John Lucking wouldn't say what was damaged in the incident, which happened on December 28th. The post office's outer door was unlocked at the time, Lucking says, to allow after-hours access to mailboxes.
We responded to the report of a burglary there, and we responded and found damage, and we secured the scene and cooperated with the federal authorities who came in to conduct their own investigation, which we supported.
He says all three defendants are lifelong residents of Sandpoint, which is home to about 1,000 people. Though the case has been turned over to federal investigators, Lucking says locals are still paying close attention.
The community is adamant they're expecting accountability here. And I think everybody feels like it was a personal violation. You know, it's everyone's post office, and, you know, people were locked out of their mail for a week, and, processes have changed, and doors have become locked now, and, it shouldn't have to be that way in Sandpoint, Alaska.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Stephanie Corder says that's a consideration as the case moves forward.
It's pretty well known that here in Alaska and our small communities, the post office in many ways is a center of community life. It's important for every member of the community, not just the people that perhaps were involved in a particular break-in or a particular incident.
Shiravloff and Wilson could face up to 5 years in jail and a $250,000 fine for each charge. Corder says the value of the damage done to the post office could affect any possible sentence. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
A Ketchikan man has been missing for nearly a month with no evidence that he left the island. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Roy Banhart was last seen on December 29th. He'd called for a taxi to take him downtown and spent some time at the 49er Bar on Water Street. He left the bar and was going to take a taxi home, apparently, but witnesses told his family that Roy was intoxicated and belligerent, so the cab driver made him get back out. That's the last reported sighting of 38-year-old Roy Banhart, and his family is anxious.
He's on the quiet side. He's been known to disappear as far as contact for a short period of time, but nothing like this.
That's Banhart's first cousin, Irene Anderson. She lives in Seattle, but is heading up the search efforts for the family. Anderson says that in early January, they reported her cousin missing to Ketchikan's police department.
They have searched Alaska Airlines records and Alaska Marine Highway records. And then I've been in contact with the local air taxis and Inter Island Ferry. So there's no indication he left town.
Ketchikan is on an island, and there's no way off except by boat or plane. The remaining explanations for what might have happened to Banhart are not good.
I'm hearing that the last time he was seen by two different friends on two different occasions, he was not in a good frame of mind and was intoxicated. So concern is that he's in the water.
Anderson says it's possible that her cousin may have committed suicide, but it's also possible that he was murdered. She says she received information from someone who wants to remain anonymous.
A party overheard a man down at Thomas Basin on December 29th, referring to Roy. And the conversation with another party indicated that this person was involved in some kind of harm to Roy, and indicated that there was a gunshot fired.
Police, though, say there's no evidence of foul play. Deputy Chief Josh Dossett offered a third possibility, that Banhart slipped and fell into the water.
We've had plenty of cases where somebody intoxicated has fallen in the water and drowned. At this point, we don't have anything to indicate, other than he's in the proximity of Kennedy, which is next to the channel, to indicate that. You know, we're just following up on any lead we get.
Dossett says the case remains open, and one officer is assigned to it. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Yukon Quest mushers dropped off all the food and gear they'll need for the 1,000-mile sled dog race in both Fairbanks and Whitehorse, Yukon over the weekend. Race manager Alex Olson says the race becomes more of a reality once all that gear has been delivered.
We're not ready. We're never all the way ready. There's always going to be something come up. There's things going to break and there's things going to change, but it's now it's on.
As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it takes mushers weeks to compile all the food and equipment they need for the race.
Circle.
Two rivers.
At least 15 volunteers have bags filled with everything from wool socks to chunks of frozen fish Central. And meat. From the back of a pickup truck.
Eagle. Circle.
But long before these polypropylene Eagle. Bags were dropped off in Fairbanks, mushers like Cody Strait had them laid out and labeled, Central. Waiting to be filled in the Circle. Driveway at Squid Acres Kennel. That's the home of the sled dogs both he and wife Paige Drobny train for mid-distance and long-distance races like the Yukon Quest.
Last year I probably had close to 40 bags total for the Yukon Quest. Right now, I've made a spreadsheet that tells how many snacks and how many meals I need at each checkpoint.
A week ago, Strait stood over a wooden table in front of his house with a knife in his hand. A strong, musty stench hung in the air.
Okay, well, I've got a couple beaver carcasses laid out here on a table outside here, and I am cutting the meat off. The meat is one of the dog's favorite snacks on a race. For some reason, this stinky, gross beaver meat is just absolutely one of their favorites.
A few feet away, there's a different kind of smell. Friend Matt Cameron mans a giant saw to slice up a long, frozen block of something green and lumpy. It's frozen tripe, or cow stomach.
How did you get to be the tripe guy?
I volunteered.
I mean, this stinks.
Yeah, it smells pretty bad. But the dogs love it.
The tripe, the beaver meat, and all kinds of other dog food are packed into the drop bags. But that's not all that goes into these bags. There's also a flurry of activity inside Cody Strait's house.
So we're
Fellow musher and friend Mandy Nauman sits on the living room floor amid a heap of hand warmers.
Any help is much needed, and I'm here to help.
She drove a team in the Yukon Quest last year, so she's familiar with the scenario playing out today.
At some point during the race, the musher is going to appreciate all the work that all their friends put in.
Over at the kitchen counter, a pot of caribou stew bubbles as longtime friend Matt Austin scoops teaspoons of red powder into small plastic bags. After he's done with that, he'll organize other dog food supplements, additives, oils, and ointments for their paws. It's a tedious job, but that's what he's here for.
It's just fun to be a part of the whole scene and help good people out and be able to give a hand and hang out with some friends and drink some beer and have some food and just be social.
Not every musher throws a drop bag party like this to prepare meals, sort dog booties, and double-check packing lists. Rookie Kristen Knight-Pace of Healy says she and husband Andrew were huddled in their one-room cabin with all her gear spread out the night before she was sent to deliver her bags to race personnel.
Yes, this is the biggest relief ever. This is like the hardest hurdle.
She says keeping track of all that stuff is an enormous challenge.
This is my first 1,000-mile race, so it's the first time I've ever had to pack for this long of a trip. And I've been thinking about it kind of like those people that thru-hike the PCT or, like, you know, they mail all of their stuff to themselves ahead of time at all these different post offices along the trail, and that's kind of how I feel this is. So it's a relief to know that it's just going off into the world and what's done is done.
Over the next 2 weeks, drop bags will be shipped to checkpoints along the 1,000-mile race trail. They'll be ready and waiting for mushers after they leave the start line of the 32nd annual Yukon Quest, February 7th in Whitehorse. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Doyon Limited, announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, encouraging e-proxy or paper proxy submission no later than Tuesday, March 10th before 5 p.m. Information at doyon.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.